usually when people are afraid, I mean, there's some seed of something to be afraid of, even if it's just failure. Like, in its pure form, it's cautionary. Or, you know, how I say, none of us would have graduated from college if we didn't have some fear. Like, you know, we only ever did any homework because we didn't want to get in trouble, right? So I think it's all about a totally different understanding of those so-called negative emotions, and then being able to separate the predictions that are irrelevant and like are just from your past experience from the ones that you want to be able to have, or that are giving you information that in a perfect world you both need and can use.
What does it take to do the impossible? What does it take to level up your game like never before? What does it take for individuals, organizations, for even institutions to achieve paradigm shifting, nothing is ever the same again, breakthroughs?
Our mission is to decode the neurobiology of flow and cognitive peak performance. Access the minds of maverick scientists, groundbreaking innovators, and world-leading experts to understand what it takes to achieve ultimate human performance, so you can feel your best, perform your best, and accomplish your boldest goals. I'm your host, Rian Doris, and together with best-selling author Stephen Kotler, I present to you Flow Research Collective Radio.
Hey there, Rian Doris here with the Flow Research Collective, and welcome to another episode of Flow Research Collective Radio. So today we've got a hell of a cool guest for you. If you've seen the TV show Billions, you'll know of the character Wendy Rhodes. She's a mindset coach for the billionaire hedge fund manager Bobby Axelrod. And if you haven't seen Billions, well, I definitely recommend you checking out the first episode. But regardless, the producers of Billions actually based the character Wendy Rhodes on a real-life peak performance coach. And her name is Denise Schull, and I'm joined by her today. Now, Denise is an expert in neuroeconomics. She's the founder of the Rethink Group, and she's the author of Market Mind Games, which is a great book that explains the deep psychological influences that can cripple Wall Street traders and financiers from a psychological perspective. In this episode, we talk in depth with Denise about her style of coaching, the kinds of psychological blockages that she helps traders overcome, and how you can apply similar practices at home to unstick your own psychology and break self-sabotaging patterns that you may be dealing with. Now, before we jump in, and because we are talking with a world-leading peak performance coach today, I wanted to make a quick announcement about our program for coaches and aspiring coaches, which is called the Flow Trainer Accelerator. So we designed the Flow Trainer Accelerator specifically for those of you who want to develop expertise in flow science and master a framework for coaching flow and peak performance. It's designed around four main pillars. The first thing that we focus on is your own individual performance. The Flow Trainer Accelerator begins by helping you shift into that sixth gear that you don't yet know you have, so that you can create great results within your own life, and of course so that you're practicing what you preach if you're going to be coaching and training others in peak performance. The second pillar involves turning you into a domain expert on the science of flow states. We've packed an entire master's degree worth of research and resources into this training so that you can emerge out the other end of the Flow Trainer Accelerator, able to speak about peak performance and flow and its surrounding topics with authority, confidence, and clarity. The third thing the Flow Trainer Accelerator does is level up your skills in the art of coaching. We give you everything you need, from a full understanding of the fundamentals of coaching through to the Flow Research Collective coaching framework, which shows you exactly how to coach flow. Finally, joining the Flow Trainer Accelerator means joining a network of like-minded peak performers who are aspiring to do more, be more, and serve at a higher level. The network's going to level you up, hold you accountable, provide you with feedback and support on your journey, which, as we all know, is crucial. So if that sounds like you, if you're a mission-driven, craft-focused coach, we want, without any disrespect, avoid the certification junkies out there who want to add another line to their LinkedIn bio. But if you are a mission-driven, craft-focused coach, then you can apply for the Flow Trainer Accelerator at flowforcoaches.com. Flow, And then four, the word four, F-O-R, coaches.com. We're capping our current cohort of 50 spots, which we're expecting to pack out pretty fast. So if training with us, learning how to become a peak performance coach is of interest, then I encourage you to dash over to flowforcoaches.com and apply. Now with that, I'm super excited to introduce you to Denise. Let's dive right in. Hey, Denise, great to have you on Flow Research Collective Radio. Really appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. We've been excited for this one big time across the whole team. So by now, people will know a little bit about you, your work in the world, what you've done and what you're known for. But I want to just kick off with a question about the field of neuroeconomics in general. Can you tell us a little bit about what neuroeconomics is and some of the research you're tracking that's coming out recently?
Yeah, in short, it's how does the brain make a decision? You know, in that phrase, neuroeconomics, economics is really a synonym for risk. And so what happens in the brain as it's like evaluating a situation, judging the probabilities, and making a risk decision? The interesting thing is when I first started studying it 15 or so years ago, they were showing that you had to have emotion to make a risk decision. And of course, like, I already kind of knew that from my psychoanalysis study and even from being a trader, but to hear them say it. And then in the interim 15 years, it's been more and more detail about what happens in the brain as you perceive, judge, and decide in the unknown, right?
What trends or updates have you been tracking in the field lately?
Yeah, the thing that I think is the most interesting is something that the researchers call anticipated affect, meaning the feeling you're anticipating you will feel. And the really ubiquitous role that anticipated affect plays in our perception and judgment. So on the cognitive side of things, there's also a lot of work going on showing that the model of the brain is prediction. That we're always predicting what's going to happen, both on a cognitive level and on an affective level, which I'll come back to. But based on everything we've learned, all of our past experience. Like, you don't know this right now because it's so in the unconscious, but you're literally predicting the next word that's going to come out of my mouth based on your familiarity with the English language. And we're always doing that. And this has been shown in lots of different experiments. But the most interesting piece for me, and I actually think for the world, is that we're predicting a feeling. So, for example, there was a study done at Stanford. It was really a meta-analysis done at Stanford showing people probability distribution, you know, the normal curve or a skewed curve. And they could really show that the very first thing that was happening in the brain was the predicting of a feeling. So, like, with a normal curve, you know, things are going to work out normally with normal sort of probabilities, the brain seems to be predicting calm. And with some sort of skewed distribution, predicting anxiety. And this was over 610 brain scans. I can't remember how many exact studies because it was a meta-analysis. That was 2012, actually. But just recently, I asked one of the researchers at Stanford, Brian Knutson, who's, by the way, big in the Society for Neuroeconomics. I said, Brian, I knew the answer to this, but I wanted to hear him say it. I said, like, how pervasive is this anticipated affect? And he said, well, it's ubiquitous. If you don't have it, you die. So I'm like, okay, well, that's pretty pervasive. Like, seems sort of black and white. It makes sense to a lot of people, but it also doesn't make sense. Like, how is it that you're predicting not only what I'm going to say, but how it's going to make you feel? This is like sort of how confirmation bias takes place, mm-hmm. and how we continue to see evidence for what we already believe, right? Because if we're looking at some situation and we're trying to be objective, but if we're really objective, it threatens like our worldview, then, you know, that creates a feeling of threat. And so like, we don't want to go there, right? It feels insecure to predict something different than we already think. It feels threatening. Mm-hmm. So we tend to not see it. We tend to see the stuff that proves what we already believe, which is obviously like you know, instructive when it comes to like the world of politics or religion or.
Yeah, you partly just there answered the question I was going to follow up with, which is what are the ways that you think about anticipated affect with respect to performance when working with individuals, both in terms of how it can cause issues and potentially how it can be leveraged to improve performance?
So what I find all the time is there's a conflict. Like part of the person believes they can do something and believes they can accomplish something, you know, and reach a higher, newer goal. And some part of them isn't so sure. But sometimes they're really aware of the part that's not so sure. You know, people's level of awareness is all over the board, right? But helping them realize they actually have a conflict and they should accept the conflict and understand it, as opposed to what everybody tries to do, which is just suppress the part that doesn't support the idea they can do it. You know, so they want to be positive, they want to be optimistic, they want to be confident, you know, they know they have to believe. And they're afraid of looking at any part of themselves that is the opposite of that in any way, you know, fear, concern, worry, doubt. They're afraid of anything of the so-called negative. Well, the way I work actually is to help people realize all of their thoughts and feelings, but believe it or not, particularly their negative thoughts and feelings that they're afraid of, because they are afraid of them and it gets in their way unconsciously. But when I'm able to help them shine sunshine there, and like we end up neutralizing the negative. I mean, the first thing that tends to happen is they just didn't even realize they had a conflict. Like, and I'll tell you, usually it comes in the form of self-criticism. You know, I should be doing this, I should be doing that, I'm not doing enough of this, I'm not doing enough of that. And then I help them see, like, there is actually some emotionally logical reason why they're not doing as much of this or not doing as much of that. That while that emotional logic may not get them to the goal, it does have some, like, meaning to them personally. And then once they see that and accept it, they're actually usually able to turn that energy and use it to help them further their goals. But in a certain sort of way, almost the more important thing that happens is it just doesn't get in their way anymore. Mm. Because when they try to suppress it, it also, you know, it has a tendency to come out at the worst moment.
A phrase I've always loved, which you reminded me of, is the idea that awareness alone is curative. And that bringing patterns, beliefs, negative behaviors, whatever it may be, into awareness, as you're saying, it may not solve the problem, but it gives you a starting point.
There is something to awareness alone, if it's accurate. Like I always tell people, the superpower is to be able to answer the question, what am I feeling and why am I feeling it? Which is a simple question, really, except it's totally not easy to answer. And the torque, the leverage, is in getting the answers right. Mm. I really am, you know, frustrated with this or afraid of that or disappointed about that. And I am those things because of whatever, X, Y, and Z. There is some like magic bullet in getting the why right. So someone can have a feeling that seems to be very disruptive. Now, I'll tell you that like it probably is very disruptive. And then there's some other way to handle it, but I'm going to come back to that. But if they get the, like the instigator of that feeling right, oftentimes it's just like, poof, it doesn't bother them anymore. They're like, oh, yeah, I am mad that my coach didn't take it seriously when, you know, or I am upset. I mean, since I deal with so many hedge fund guys, you know, I am mad at myself that, you know, I cut the euro and would have made, you know, $4.2 billion if I hadn't done it. Like, I tell people all the time, those fears, frustrations, and disappointments in their pure form have some message for you. Like, when you're disappointed of your performance, the message is supposed to be you're uncomfortable, so you figure out what you could have done better, right? Mm-hmm. Like, usually when people are afraid, I mean, there's some seed of something to be afraid of, even if it's just failure. Like, in its pure form, it's cautionary or, you know, how I say, none of us would have graduated from college if we didn't have some fear. Like, you know, we only ever did any homework because we didn't want to get in trouble, right? So I think it's all about a totally different understanding of those so-called negative emotions and then being able to separate the predictions that are irrelevant and like are just from your past experience from the ones that you want to be able to have or that are giving you information that in a perfect world you both need and could use, if that makes any sense. I realize
absolutely,
it's a bit esoteric.
The way that Stephen likes to describe emotions is as signaling mechanisms, meaning, you know, they're usually an indicator that something needs to be done or some action needs to be taken. When someone's having paralyzing rumination, it's likely because they need to have a conversation that they're avoiding having, for example. I want to back up just a little bit, Denise, and ask you about the work you do in general. And also, I want to touch on the TV show Billions, because a lot of people I know you through that. So could you tell us two things? One, about how you describe the work you do and who you do it with. And then could you give us a little bit of background on how the character Wendy Rhodes ended up being built around you and your work within the TV show Billions and how that all came about?
Yeah. How I think of my work is solve the unsolvable. Not to sound egomaniacal or anything, but I really do think of it that way. Like the mental blocks that people get into, the kind of standard zeitgeist in psychology doesn't quite address. Like the problems that people almost solve, but don't solve, particularly don't solve through cognition, don't solve through trying to change their thoughts or change their focus. So I'm like, let's figure out what's really going on for that person emotionally in whatever challenge they're facing. And I'm, you know, we're 90 some percent of the people, if we figure out what's really going on emotionally, which oftentimes isn't what the person thinks, we reveal the block in sort of Stephen's signaling way. And the block will have meaning. I mean, to use Jennifer Lerner of Harvard, she calls emotions either integral or incidental. Integral meaning meant to help you, and incidental meaning irrelevant. So like in markets, I'll use intuition or impulsive. But the trick is to think of all those feelings and emotions as information and then figure out, well, what information are they giving you? And then which part of your life is the information about? So like, is it about your current challenge that you're trying to rise to? Or the problem you're trying to solve. I mean, like, I get called in a lot of times. I mean, I do get called in a lot of times for problems that other methods haven't solved. Like, you know, the hedge fund manager who's in a slump, the athlete who's in a slump. But I just work on what's the real emotional logic for this person, and then how much do they know? How much are they willing to know? How much resistance do they have to knowing? Because some of them don't really want to know because they're protecting some narrative.
Could you give us an example of someone you work with, maybe the typical individual, and a big challenge and blockage that you would resolve, and you know what the consequences of that might be for the individual?
The one that comes up in the hedge fund world over and over is guys who have been superstars in some big hedge fund, and then they go out on their own and they get capitalized because they've built a reputation for themselves. And then when they're out on their own, they can't produce results. And everybody's like, what happened to this person? You know, and they try and they beat their head against the wall, and they're the person themselves is like, have I lost it? And oh my God, I can't do it on my own, you know? And oftentimes, and at least a superficial, I think all these things exist in a layered form. Okay. Like, you know, there's the obvious kind of logical layer, and then they become more personal as you get deeper into more layers. But the one that happens with hedge fund guys all the time, it comes out they hate actually being the boss. Like they hate having to manage people. They hate having to deal with the lawyers. They hate having to deal with investors. And if they just accept that they hate it, it can help them perform better. Now, there'll be reasons that they hate it.
Is it that from where they're positioned, they just can't see that they hate it, or they won't acknowledge it, or they're working on faulty assumptions? What's going on in their mind when they're...
They usually don't know it. Now, they usually sort of know it, but they feel guilty about it. Like, I went out on my own, you know, I put my name on the door. I should be able to handle institutional investors and in compliance and accounting and hiring a team of analysts. And they feel guilty and they beat themselves up for not wanting to do that part of the business, which then anytime you're, you know, beating yourself up and it's impacting your confidence, it impacts your performance, particularly in something as hard as like figuring out what the market's going to do, which is mentally, that's really the, you know, one of the hardest challenges on the planet because it's so uncertain and because the signals are so mixed up, you know, like in the market, you never know, like a signal that in a sport would be clear, something's good or bad. In the market, it could be good or bad. Like it's just totally ambiguous all the time. So like losing your sense of self because you're failing in an area and then criticizing yourself, getting yourself really off balance psychologically really messes you up in something as tenuous as trading and investing.
That makes sense. And then, so just to loop it back to the original question, it's mainly the financial world that you work with. Can you give us an idea of who you work with, what working with them would look like, and feel free to be super detailed in terms of what interactions look like, et cetera.
You know, I've worked with hundreds of guys who run money for institutional investors. And that, you know, that has all kinds of different forms. I mean, we call it run money, right? But like you can run money and trade in commodities like coffee, cocoa, sugar. You know, you can run money and trade purely stocks. You can trade currencies. You can trade all of the above. You can trade fundamentally, meaning you try to find out everything about the company and predict how much money they're going to make. Or you can trade technically, which is purely on pictures and charts of support and resistance. You can do some combination of all of that. In companies, I usually start out with a workshop that's all about like what you thought about decision making isn't the way you make a decision. Like you have to have emotion. How much confidence you have matters. Conviction is a physical experience because they always talk about feeling convicted. Like I'll do this. I'll give a presentation. I'll say, how many people in the audience, you know, are their central part of their strategy is being convicted? Everybody raises their hand. How many people in the audience think you have to take emotion out of market decisions? And 95% of the people raise their hand. I'm like, conviction is an emotion. It's like a physical sense that you are right. Like, that's an emotion. And they'll go like, so in a corporation, like I teach them all this science about how emotion really works and risk perception. But with an individual, I get them in a room for half of the day and map out their life. What their problem is now, which is usually some version of, you know, why am I not making more money? Here's a great one. This is one of my most dramatic stories. And this one's been a while ago. This guy called me in a hedge fund and says, you know, I used to be fabulous, super intuitive. Everybody knew I was, you know, one of the greatest traders around. And then, like, I lost it. And I really haven't made any decent money in 10 years. And I'm like, thinking to myself, 10 years. Like, managed to bounce around jobs. My wife had been kidnapped. I dealt with that. Like, you know, that's all good now. And I was like, wait, your wife had been kidnapped? And he's like, yeah, for dad's money and blah, blah. And I'm like, I'm thinking there's no way he's good with this. And sure enough, I got him to ultimately admit that he felt, you know, responsible. And essentially, I almost hate to use this word, but like impotent to have protected her. But yet in his sort of zest to be positive after she was released and safe and put it behind him, he'd never really dealt with how powerless it made him feel. And, you know, that goes to like his whole self-image, right? And once he agreed that, well, yeah, I did, you know, I did feel powerless and I feel guilty and feel like I totally screwed up and like, why couldn't I protect her? And was just able to be aware that he really did have those feelings. And I think feel them. I think it doesn't work to just say it. You have to like, the words got to connect to, you know, and it's got to resonate. It's got to make sense. Literally in his case, the slump just stopped. He just started making money again and then went on a really great streak. You know, I didn't think of a bunch of client stories before we started talking, but I have scores of those. Like, I had a guy once who always lost money in the morning and made money in the afternoon and had tried to solve it every which way from Sunday. And we ultimately connected it to that he'd been born to a 16-year-old runaway and started life in poverty and then was kind of like adopted, at least practically, by the running coach. And then his life took this upward trajectory. And he was literally like repeating his life story in everyday's trading, trying to work out all his feelings about that. And once he saw that, he never lost money in the morning again.
Hey there, Rian here. I hope you're enjoying hearing how Denise works with clients. And I wanted to quickly remind you that if you are a coach, a consultant, or a service provider, or you're aspiring to become a performance coach like Denise, then the Flow Trainer Accelerator was designed just for you. It helps you master the art of coaching others in peak performance and flow so that you can produce the kinds of client results that Denise talks about here. We're capping our current cohort of 50 people and we're looking for mission-driven, craft, and client-focused coaches only. So if that's you and this is of interest, then just go to flowforcoaches.com. So flowforcoaches.com and apply for the Flow Trainer Accelerator there. Now, let's dive straight back into the episode with Denise. So they're great examples, though, of where awareness alone is actually curative, it sounds like. I don't want to derail us too much off the billions question, but what sometimes is needed if awareness alone is not curative, if someone, okay, gets the insight and cognitively they are clear that such and such pattern is causing such and such undesired result, but the pattern doesn't break. How do you deal with that? And I'm asking that question with a number of things in mind. One is the whole Bessel van der Kolk, body keeps the score hypothesis around trauma and the idea that the issues are in the tissues and that, you know, some kind of somatic experience or embodied experience is needed to resolve certain inner traumas or challenges. But what do you tend to opt to or attempt to do if awareness alone is not curative?
The short version is get them comfortable with their rage that they usually don't know they have or they're defended against. I learned this from a group of modern psychoanalysts, which no one's ever heard of, but it's this group that split off from the classical Freudian psychoanalysts. So like a Freudian psychoanalyst wants you to know, to figure out, you know, you do X in adulthood because Y happened to you when you were a kid. And that's called interpretation, and it's oftentimes very helpful to people. It's oftentimes not. Like interpretation, which is it leads to awareness, right? Doesn't work, the exact question you're asking. Well, when awareness doesn't work, it's basically because the person is defended against having all their feelings. They have reasons they don't want to know everything that they feel. And I won't say 100% of the time, but almost 100% of the time, it lies in what they're angry about that they have no awareness of. And even if they start to get some awareness of, are afraid to know, and afraid to know because of what they'll do with it. So they have some sort of rage. It's hard for me to use that word, but it's the truth. And they're afraid of how they'll act it out. And so they shut themselves off from it. The modern psychoanalysts actually figured out that they could be of value to schizophrenics with this, and that in certain cases in schizophrenia, the out-of-reality experiences were about splitting that off, splitting the feelings off to be able to manage the intensity of the feelings so that they could help the people accept the feelings without any judgment. They would have less need to split them off into crazy behaviors. And the truth is, like, I ended up here because I was sitting in a class with modern psychoanalysts and they were talking about this unconscious rage helping schizophrenics. And I don't mean to make light of that, but like it went off in my head, like, well, gee, if it helps schizophrenics, it would help these crazy traders I worked with. That was literally like the seed of this. But I will work to help a client understand what they're angry about that they don't realize. And in that angry about, which feelings are they afraid of having? So like I have a guy now who really hired me for leadership and like connecting to people more, but that's related to leadership, right? But he has like a list of ways that you need to be in the business world. He also has a list of things he is still somewhat insecure about, but was definitely insecure about like in high school and college. I know that those feelings of insecurity have to come from his family somehow. Like I know for this guy, these things that he feels insecure about, he had to get those feelings when he was really little. He wants to attribute them to high school, you know, and sort of not being tall enough and not being fast enough. So I know he's defended. So I will work very gingerly. What's different about, like, I will try to help someone find their unconscious rage, but I won't make them find it. Learning from the modern psychoanalysts, we try to work with the resistance as opposed to just bust through it. Like the theory is if we just bust through that and tell them what's really going on, all that happens is the walls go up more. So like what's happening with that guy? He's actually not gaining that much awareness. And whenever I ask the kind of question where he would, he's like, no, you know, no, he'll give me something. That's not it. You know, that's not it. I told you that's not it. He'll get kind of irritated. And then he'll say, but you know, I was in this situation the other day and I was thinking about like, I could hold back like usual, or I could just say, you know, F it, I'm just doing it. This will happen sometimes with people who are defended. Their behavior will change even without awareness.
Well, that's the other great side of the coin to mention, is that sometimes awareness is necessary. And they talk about that within some of the trauma modalities like sensory motor sequencing, that remembering the event that caused the issue is not necessarily going to make a difference. Technically, right. You could process through the event and its consequential or its implications without actually ever getting full clarity on what had happened to you. So I'm glad that we've gone a roundabout way to talking about Billions and the Wendy Rhodes character, because everyone now is obviously aware of why she was based on you. But can you give us a little bit of a background as to how that came about?
Yeah, so I was on Squawk Box with Andrew Ross Sorkin in 2012 to talk about my book, Market Mind Games. And I didn't actually know it at the time, but he had started working on the pilot. Then it was in 15 when he'd met the other two executive producers, showrunners, and he contacted me and said, hey, I'm doing this drama thing, and would you work with the actress? And I was like, what are you talking about? So Maggie then asked me if I would work with her. Maggie Siff, who plays Wendy Rhodes, asked me if I'd work with her and if I would meet the other writers. And so I went into the writer's room and I did, like, I told them all sorts of stories. I remember I told them the kidnapping story. I told them all sorts of stories and this whole really psychoanalytical, but psychoanalytical just means like what's going on in someone's unconscious or subconscious and how do you become aware of that? Because who would think that applies to people trading and making money, that, you know, you use the market as an authority figure and like you work out your issues with your father vis-a-vis the market, but that's what guys do. And women, there aren't that many women in the business. So then, yeah, I consulted with them on that. And then, you know, they continued to use things that they learned in my book. And then I actually, when it first came out, didn't want to admit to it because I was like, I'm actually not a dominatrix. And like, I didn't know how much that was going to be part of her character. And then everybody, like I couldn't, in the first 6 weeks of that show, I must've had like half a dozen journalists call. Every, you know, cocktail party or conference or meeting I went to in New York, it was like, oh my God, Denise. And I was like, you know what? I don't think I'm going to be able to escape this. And so then I finally just said, well, yeah, they did call me and I did contribute. And yeah.
Nice. No, I love it. It's funny. Sometimes I've had experiences where I've described in a bar or in an Uber or things like that, what we do at the Flow Research Collective, to people briefly, and their response is surprisingly often, oh, is it kind of like that Wendy woman in Billions? So it's really interesting to.
I was working the other day, I'm on a panel this week with a group, acceptance and commitment therapy, and a sports psychologist that works with an NBA and MLB team. And he's like, it got so much easier after the show when I tried to explain what I did with the athletes. I could just say, you know, like that Wendy woman. So yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Nice, even a sports psychologist guy. So
So I would love to dive back into your process for working with people. So you mentioned that the first thing you do is figure out what their problem is now. And you were describing the duration of time you work with them and what that looks like. Could you go back into that description of what an engagement tends to look like?
I'm actually supposed to start with a baseball guy tomorrow. And so I'll just say what I told him. Like, I like to get someone in a room for 3 years, hear what they're trying to solve, and then hear their life story and hear how much they understand about their challenge. And while they're telling me all that, I'm making an assessment of what's really going on. Like, I'm making an assessment of how aware they are, how open to all their feelings they are. Are they okay with knowing fear, frustration, disappointment? You know, are they aware that there's poppy stuff they're angry about, or are they not? Are they open to being aware? Like, I had a Broadway director I did this with who was having difficulty with dealing with the actors, and you know, had some famous actors. And once this person realized they were just angry about kind of being pushed around by the team of the famous people, they were able to go in and say, you know what, you're not pushing me around anymore. But before that, they felt guilty about being angry about it. But usually in those first few hours, I can connect whatever problem they're telling me. Like, guys will tell me that they stay in positions in the market too long. Here's a good one. You know, they're in some position in the market. It's not making money. They know they should get out, but they can't get out. And they stay in it, and it loses more money. And they look back over their year, and they realize, you know, those four times that I got stubborn is what made the difference. That if I hadn't gotten stubborn four times, I would have made a lot more money. So a classic one in getting stubborn is I'll ask them about their family, how many brothers and sisters they have. And you'd be shocked at the number of people who were like the youngest child who get stubborn. Well, why? Because like the youngest child grows up wanting to be as smart as their older siblings, you know, wanting to prove themselves. Just because, you know, no matter what, they don't know, you know, they're two and their brother and sister are six and seven, you know, whatever. Like, they never know, you don't know as much until you're well into your 20s. So I will see, I'll be able to surmise at that point that the emotional experience the person's having is a replication of an emotional experience they had growing up. And I'll imagine in my mind, like, okay, and I'll even say, like, well, I'm just wondering if, you know, you're saying you feel like this over here when you're trying to solve this problem. It sounds to me like that would be how you would have felt in this situation you told me about. When, like, I have a client who just told me about his parents just leaving him go on a vacation and not caring what happened to him. And, you know, and like, he was really way too young for that to have happened. And then his thing in the market is sort of wanting to matter and have significance. Well, I mean, he was kind of neglected. So I will try to listen to how they experience their current problem and listen to whatever they tell about their life story. And in my mind, I'm thinking, what would it feel to have this current problem? Now, they usually don't even know how they feel, right? But what would their feelings be in this current problem? And how would those feelings just repeat how they would have felt in some sort of thing from growing up? And I can pretty much always find how they would have felt in the theme of growing up in whatever they're saying is their problem now. That they usually can't see that. And then it becomes a matter of how willing and able are they to connect those two? And how willing and able are they to actually have the feelings they defended themselves, they defended against growing up? So the typical one that people defend against, well, they defend against being angry, but they do it by being self-critical. So I'll oftentimes throw out like kind of an interpretation or a piece of education to see if they grab onto it or if they go, oh, no, that's not me. So you'll get people who are perfectionists, who their perfectionism gets in their way. And, you know, then you'll find out that if they're perfectionists, they have some level of self-critical, like they have to be this in order to get that. I'll then figure out, you know, somehow they felt pretty criticized growing up. And I'll want to know if they can admit to that. And some people are like, oh, no way. Like, I know this. Whenever anybody tells me they had a wonderful childhood and everything was perfect, I know, like, I'm in trouble. Because it's just not that common. Right? And I will, maybe I'll throw out, you know, one way that kids deal with the uncontrollable is to say it's their fault. Like, this is a real thing. You know, you're a kid, crap's going wrong at home, you can't do anything about it because you're 8 years old. And a way that a kid oftentimes feels more secure is to blame it on themselves, because it gives them a sense of agency, a sense of power. You know, well, if I behave better, if I ate my dinner, if I did my schoolwork, if I went to bed, you know, whatever, then maybe mom and dad wouldn't fight, just for example. Well, what happens is some people never outgrow that. The idea that it's my fault continues to give them a sense of control. But it's usually distorted, right? That wasn't their fault. And as an adult, finding additional ways to criticize yourself isn't actually helping you, because you're not in reality, right? Like, you're, you know, either demanding too much of yourself, or you're just not seeing your situation for what it is, because you're essentially narcissistically blaming yourself.
That's interesting.
I start out with this in-depth making an assessment of where they are, what's really going on for them, how willing they are to know it, what they're defended resistant to, and then, like, ask questions. And, you know, I'll give them homework to write about something, or, you know, to read certain books. I started thinking about a client there, a 20-year-old would-be soccer player who's compulsively gotten injured as a way of preventing actually playing professional soccer.
What are some of the most common journaling or writing exercises that you'll give as homework? And what are some of the most common books that you tend to recommend?
The books I'm recommending these days are Permission to Feel by Mark Brackett, The Upside of Your Dark Side. I do recommend The Body Keeps the Score. How Emotions Are Made by Lisa Feldman Barrett. I usually don't recommend my own book, but I mean, in a certain sort of way, it's kind of advanced, because it's really about, like, how people project onto the market and how the market becomes an authority figure. And so, like, you have to be kind of ready to be psychologically aware, really, to go through the stuff in my book. But the writing will be like, write about, I use what's the worst that could happen as a really pivotal question. People are afraid to face that, but often if they do, they find things that they think they're afraid of or think they are terrified of, that when they face, they go, well, that would be really bad, but, you know, X, Y, and Z, like, either that won't happen, or it's unlikely to happen, or I could do this, that, or the other thing to prevent that from happening. Like, they don't, back to that whole anticipated affect, people have a tendency to predict disaster, but they don't know they're doing it. And when they recognize that they're predicting disaster, they go, oh, well, maybe that'll happen, but, you know, there's these 9 reasons why it won't happen, or these 4 things I can do to prevent that, and then they're able to focus on it. So a lot of my writing is dark. It's like, what are the things you're angry about? Or, you know, they'll tell me about a scenario, you know, and I'll have them try to remember everything that they can remember about that scenario, and why they were really angry, or why they felt really dismissed or overlooked or blamed. You know, like, what I know is there's research that shows the more you can differentiate amongst your negative emotions, the less they get in your way.
That's a really great way to sum it up. So the more of a nuanced understanding you can develop about your own negative emotions, essentially, the more in control you are.
Yeah. And it's super hard in these days of, you have to be positive, you have to be optimistic. None of your friends will listen to you talk about your fears, frustrations, and disappointments, because they're like afraid of the energy. Like, it's super hard, and people feel guilty, and they're not, you know, on Instagram, you know, you're supposed to be positive. Like,
yeah, exactly. I mean, an analogy that I like to use personally is thinking of those things as obstacles, let's say, in front of you on a road. If you can see the obstacle, you can jump over it or walk around it or do whatever is required. But if the obstacle is not within your vision, you're just going to keep tripping over it. And that's the danger, as you're mentioning, of, you know, excessive emphasis on the positive. So what are some of the other, before we get off the journaling topic, what are some of the other journaling practices you recommend? It sounds like specifically journaling on negative emotions or challenging circumstances is a helpful way.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like, on one hand, I have this process that's about helping people know all of their thoughts and feelings understanding them as information, being able to connect them to their real source. On the other hand, I feel like it's always so personal. Like it's, you know, fear, frustration, disappointment are like fingerprints. A person's actual experience of them, you know, we'll never actually know, right? Like we never know whether their physical experience is the same as my physical experience. You know, there's crazy things in neuroscience, like, you know, you do 2 + 2 = 4 a different way in your brain, depending on whether you're raised with a Germanic language or an Asian language. How can 2 + 2 = 4? Like that's an area that I try to understand the research. Like how is language, why is language what it is? And how does it have the power that it does? Now, I don't have the answers to that. I don't think anyone has the answers to that yet. But I do feel like that's part of the cutting edge of psychological research. Like, you know, there's the whole idea that like, we don't have certain feelings if we don't have a word for them, you know. Now, that's controversial. That's Lisa Feldman Barrett and how emotions are made, which she says that, I think it's the Tahitians don't have the same concept of sadness that we do. I mean, I'll be out on the over the edge of my skis here if I really try to talk about this research. But like what I know is in modern psychoanalysis, which by the way, was started by a guy named Hyman Spotnitz, and like I said, thrown out of classical Freudian psychoanalysis. Like their motto is say everything. They just want a client to come in and say everything. And I'll tell my clients that sometimes. I'll say, like I had 2 clients today talking to me about their wives in the pandemic and being home a lot, you know, and arguing more. They're like, why shouldn't we be talking about that? I'm like, no. Like, I want you to say everything. I want to give you the space where we can find out everything there is to know about you. Like, all your thoughts and feelings, and then connect, put the jigsaw puzzle together as to what conflicts you have between what you want and what you really feel or believe, or conflicts you have between feeling this and feeling that, and, you know, they can't coexist. And what's distorted? I mean, there's a lot of distortion in all of this, where people think it's one thing or it's another. So I'll go on to work with people to answer your earlier question. Like, I have a lot of clients I talk to twice a week. And they can all text me or email me anytime, but hardly anyone ever does. And I'll go on like that for months, you know, into years. And then the frequency tends to lessen. Or people will, you know, I won't work with someone actively for a little while and then they'll pop back up.
So to recap your process, and hopefully I'm doing it justice here, it sounds like it's identifying the current problem, getting a really comprehensive sense of their life story as they tell it or interpret it, extracting the themes from it, and then seeing how some of the major themes are giving rise to the current problem they're facing, and then encouraging them to confront the feelings or emotions associated with that. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I probably wouldn't use the word confront. I will put all that in. First, me understanding what are they feeling and why are they feeling it. And then my leading them to them understanding what am I feeling and why am I feeling it. And then neutralizing the feelings that are irrelevant and distorted. And maybe being able to transform those feelings into the feelings you want, like, you know, fear into focus or anger into power or disappointment into preparation. But confront, it's more like I don't confront. Because that's a little bit too close to Freudian interpretation. I will offer, I will serve up in more or less direct ways. I mean, some guys are, like I had a guy tell me last week, you know, I hired you to tell me how the hell my childhood is getting in my way of investing. Okay, well, we can do that, but, you know, I don't just hit them in the face with it. I offer it up like, you know, a waiter in a restaurant saying our specials today are, and seeing how they react.
Yeah, David Rock's research at the NeuroLeadership Institute really emphasizes that point, that an insight that has been arrived at by the individual is much, much, much more impactful in terms of the impact it will have on behavior and belief than an insight that you are articulating to them. They have to arrive on it themselves. But
to that end, I try to not ever tell them. I fail at that.
Right.
But I try.
And that's part of the challenge, I think, in any coaching. yeah. or facilitation is to resist the urge to tell them what the hell is wrong with them and let them get there on their own.
Well, they ask me too. They tell me, tell me. And I'll be like, how's it going to help you if I tell you? They're like, well, then I'll know. And I'm like, it'll just be my opinion. They're like, I want your opinion. Yeah, they'll pressure me to tell them.
It's a different form of knowing, though. How would someone go about implementing somewhat of a similar process within their own life on their own? Is there a way to self-identify and sort of self-guide through a similar process? And are there any tools you'd recommend for folks to do that?
Yeah. The first is to make the decision that you're not afraid of knowing what you're feeling and why you're feeling it. Just make the decision that all of your thoughts and feelings have some information in them, and you want to find that information. Now, for some people, that leads to this litany of self-criticism. So I'm going to say, know that that litany of self-criticism protected you at some point, and it's a defense mechanism, and therefore not objectively true. It feels true to you, seems true to you. It's actually protecting probably your family from your real feelings. So just decide. And then read books. Understand the feelings in your dreams. I do use dreams. I don't use them in any sort of, you know, this thing means that. I mean, like some story about whatever, doesn't matter what the story is. It's the feeling in the dream. Like, it's just the feeling. We have the craziest story in the world. But, you know, like I had a guy who's like afraid of what his father is going to do if he changes his profession. And, you know, he's having these dreams, and like literally one of them, he was in a fight with his father. And I'm like, could it be that, you know, and people can find out a lot about what they're really feeling if they just analyze their dreams in a simple way. What are the feelings the dream is serving up to me? Don't care about the crazy story, you know? And at the end of the day, this is being empathetic to yourself, like being that understanding, kind, accepting counselor or adult that you would have wanted, like for yourself.
Any other tools or practices or habits you would recommend, like journaling, for example, as one approach?
I am not so much like, if journaling, you know, comes natural to you, do it. My only thing I want people to do is be introspective in whatever form introspective works for you. So, which is asking, what am I feeling and why am I feeling it? Like, you know, for some people that's meditation. For some people that's running a marathon. For some people that's journaling. Again, I go back to the fingerprint thing. We all have these repetitive feelings and we all have these sets of explanations, but they're very personal, and how we get to them is personal. So I'm not one of, you know, everybody should do X, Y, and Z. I do think everybody should get a lot of sleep. And I'm also like a little bit of a zealot about keto and like everyone should eat less carbs. And those things are related. Like, you know, getting less carbs is related to getting better sleep, and getting better sleep is like, it enables you to be more empathetic to yourself and less self-critical ultimately. Like, because you just wake up feeling more energized, and if you feel more energized, you're less likely to be agitated and irritable.
We like to talk about those sorts of fundamental resourcing habits as the positive psychology basics, those things that just for any human being will give you more capacity to do the more specific thing you're trying to do.
Yeah, I got the continuous glucose monitor. I've got the Oura Ring. I've been keto for years now. The glucose thing has been super interesting to see. Like, literally, my glucose tends to go low, to see the impact of just walking around and stabilizing it. Or if I do get irritated, how it spikes. Like, it's amazing. Or if my heart rate doesn't go down to its lowest point, you know, early in the night, like 2 a.m. If it doesn't go down to its lowest point until 4, 5, you feel less rested.
Yeah, that tool, and just for folks who are listening, a continuous glucose monitor, CGM, is remarkable in terms of getting a sense. For anyone who wants to delve deep into the biohacking quantified self side of things, it is remarkable to just see in real time how foods you eat, behaviors that you do, have such a dramatic impact on your body.
Amazing.
Yeah. Denise, I want to wrap with a final question on flow state, which is what our primary focus is here at the Flow Research Collective. How does flow show up within your client relationships? How do you think about flow? Do you attempt to implement it with some of the traders and hedge fund managers that you work with? Where does it show up within your work?
I think it's super important, and I think it's, you know, what we're all striving for. The way I work with it is try to interrupt like the bottom 25% of your performance. So if we can eradicate the things that are getting in your way, there's just going to be a lot more space for flow. There's going to be a lot more energy for it. So that's my particular take on like getting rid of the things that get in your way so that you have more bandwidth, literally mentally and time-wise. You're not wasting as much time on being agitated and distracted, disrupted to deliver, you know, a flow-based performance.
Nice. Yeah, we talk about the flow blockers a lot, which are very much so in line with that. Just to wrap, is there a quote that you would like to share as a parting word that you've been thinking about recently? It can be a quote that you've come up with yourself or something you've been thinking about or a quote from someone you admire.
Well, it's we perceive what we believe. So be careful what you believe. You know, We perceive what we believe. So you got to work with what you believe because otherwise it contours or distorts your perception.
I love that. That's powerful. Well, listen, thanks a million, Denise. Can you let everyone know where they can find you and dive deeper?
Yeah. My consulting company is called The Rethink Group, and it was really meant for rethink feelings and emotions, rethink thinking, but we're the rethinkgroup.net. You know, we have a standard contact us. I'm on Twitter. It's Denise K. Scholl.
Super. Well, thanks so much, Denise. It was amazing to get to chat with you, and I hope we do so again. I hope you enjoyed hanging out with Denise. I know it was really epic for me personally to get to speak to the real life person behind the Wendy Rhodes character at different times when friends or family or otherwise asked me, you know, what do you guys do at the Flow Research Collective? I would actually use that example. You know, I'd say, have you ever seen Billions? You know, that mindset coach? Well, it's a little bit like that. So it was really cool to get to speak with her directly, and I hope it was of value to you as well. Now, quick thing before you bounce, if you want to discover what's stopping you from experiencing flow states and you do not have the luxury of doing a deeper dive into the depths of your mind with someone like Denise, well, then take our free flow blocker diagnostic. It's not going to be quite the same as working directly with someone like Denise, but it's 3 minutes long and it'll tell you what's blocking you from peak performance, whether that's motivation, lack of clarity, or one of the other 8 flow blockers. We'll also send you some really cool free tools to help you overcome whatever your exact flow blocker is. So head over to flowblocker.com and check that out. And then finally, just to remind you, if you're a coach, a consultant, or a service provider, and you want to become an expert in flow science to learn to coach others in flow, then go to flowforcoaches.com to apply to train with us through the Flow Trainer Accelerator. That's Flow for Coaches. We'd be excited to speak with you and see if it's a fit. Now, thank you as always for listening to Flow Research Collective Radio. Super grateful for your time, energy, and attention. And I'm excited to catch you next time. We got some amazing episodes in store. All the best.